Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I speak to old Eds who left the school and pursued lots of wonderful careers in all sorts of different areas. I've been hugely lucky to speak, well, I think this might be coming up to our 30th episode now of Ed Talks. And it really is a fabulous podcast, especially for those listening who are still at school, to realise there are so many things that you can do after you cross Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time. Today, I'm talking to a man. Well, you know what, Howard? I'm going to ask you to explain your career to us in a second, because I've made some notes here. The focus of your professional life, Howard, has been the practice, research and teaching. It's always been youth, hasn't it? But that's taken you to, well, different countries. It's taken you to work with universities, with governments. Howard Williamson, 1972. Welcome to Ed Talks. Tell us a bit about you.
Thank you, Ben. It's very difficult. The first problem is probably calling it a career, because there was no plan attached to it. I was always a bit of a rebel, I think, from quite a young age in a lot of different ways. And King Edward School helped me to almost consolidate my rebelliousness through being confident to be rebellious, although also probably tried to knock me into shape in terms of working out where I should really go and get a proper job and so on. But I think the connection with youth was very much attributed to schooling, leaving the Scouts and becoming involved in care for the elderly in Balsall Heath, done in a very paternalistic and patronising way by Canon Lunt, the chief master, when he talked about, you know, what are we doing for our poorer neighbours on our doorstep? But I went along there and talked to an old lady once for an hour once a week on a Friday afternoon. And then by chance, I bumped into a bunch of students who were building an adventure playground, which turned into the St. Paul's Community Project in Balsall Heath many years later. But it was literally the first railway sleepers that were laid on that adventure playground that started that project. And I helped the students unload the van and asked them what they were doing and building an adventure playground. What's that? And I got involved in adventure play and youth work through that and through where I lived at home in North Worcestershire. And I've remained very sort of hands-on, practically involved in youth work. But as you say, over the years, I became a kind of part-time academic, doing a lot of research on young people's issues, writing a lot about young people. I've done a 50-year ethnography of young offenders, who I will see tomorrow afternoon, because they're having a bit of a reunion, a bit of a gathering. They're all 61 years old.
Is this the Milltown boys?
Yeah, the Milltown boys.
You might want to ask me more about that later. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, the Milltown boys. And I've also become involved in policy. And again, I was probably lucky that Wales started to divide from England. So I had a sort of an extra level of governance to relate to. I was invited at quite a young age by ministers to chair one or two committees on drugs and on youth work. And then I was very closely involved in Tony Blair's government in the 90s, but also the European Commission, the Council of Europe and the United Nations. So I really do live a bizarre life where I go to a posh black tie dinner at the old Royal Naval College in Greenwich, which I did 2 weeks ago. And last night I was sitting at a Pontypridd Town Association Football Club development section meeting of the coaches in the non-political working men's club in Hawthorne, which is an old spit and sawdust working men's club that's seen better days. So
we need to be careful venturing onto football, Howard, because I know that you're a big Aston Villa fan. So am I. And we could end up spending this whole conversation talking about the Villa and the signings that Stephen Gerrard's already made over the summer. But we won't do that. We will stick
we'll avoid that
with the career side of things. But you are now based in South Wales. But before we go into your career, because you left school, you went to Cardiff University, got a PhD. Was that in Wales too? You got your PhD?
Yeah, and I did it on the Milltown. It was an early piece of work on the Milltown boys, really. It was looking at their relationship to the criminal justice system.
Yes. Fab. So Wales has obviously been in your life for a very long time. But before we talk about that, let's go back to Birmingham. So you left school in 1972. So therefore would have started 1964, 65?
65, yeah.
What was Birmingham like in the 60s? The Birmingham you remember?
Yeah, the Birmingham I remember. Well, it certainly Balsall Heath was still very Victorian. But there was also a kind of modernity about Birmingham. I mean, Jim Grant and I, Lee Child and I, used to go to the West Midlands Arts Centre, as and I think we were probably the first cohort of schoolboy members, you know, learning to strum Canned Heat's Going Up the Country, the three chords of Canned Heat on guitars in soundproof music rooms at the Midlands Arts Centre. So it was this mixture, and it was a huge, you know, Birmingham was a huge place. I'd not long moved from Kent, where I'd lived in a council house, backing onto fields near the A20. But, you know, if you mention the A20 these days, it's all about lorry parks and, you know, Dover and congestion. All I remember was, you know, riding a bike. My dad was the only person who had a car on the estate. So it was a very different kind of life. And then we moved to North Worcestershire to quite a large house in West Hagley, a you know, rather nice village. But traveling into Birmingham to the smoke, the big city, and, you know, going around on those old Birmingham Corporation buses, it was a, you know, it was a great thing for me as a teenager to be at a great school in a great city with a great load of music. And, you know, on the weekends, we won't talk about football too much, but I was a footballer, never a rugby player. So one thing I didn't like about King Edwards was the compulsion to play rugby and no option of playing football.
Well, you mentioned before we started recording, you always had a slight rebellious streak, and that you're always trying to, in some way, not annoy the teachers, but just kind of try and push your luck. Do you think that, because obviously, you know, it's a school with thousands of kids in it these days anyway. I don't know what it was like when you were there in terms of the overall numbers, but hundreds of kids go to this school.
Yeah, 600, about 600, yeah.
And therefore, you know, you've got to teach them the same things. They're going to the same classes with the same teachers. But it sounds like you got quite good personal attention in the sense that they almost had your number. They wanted to not squash the rebellious nature, but to kind of mould it almost and put that energy into the right direction. Do you think that was it? Did that happen for you at King Edward School? Do you think if you'd gone somewhere else that may not have happened in the same way?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure of that. I think, you know, with hindsight, I certainly have to acknowledge that the school, yes, it probably did try to corral me into a better form of behaviour, you know, getting my hair cut. I mean, I still, you can't see, I know you can see me. And, you know, I've still got dreadlocks from chairing a community project, Birmingham Young Volunteers.
And can we just say at this point, because I can see you on Zoom, the yeah. Aston Villa CBE earring as well.
Yeah, well, that again is, you know, it's almost slightly Republican and sort of anti-gong regalia. I just happened to bump into a guy many years ago who is a goldsmith. And when I did get a CBE, I took the CBE in and I said to Rob, do you think you can make an earring out of that? Because it's claret and blue. And it's a bit like wearing a CBE Villa earring in my ear.
Although that, even if it was a CBE, you probably wouldn't have been able to wear that earring at school. That may have been a step too far for the halls of King Edward's.
Well, should I really say this? I mean,
absolutely.
I had never really wanted to have earrings. They didn't really prevail at all at any level, certainly in terms of my class background and so on. But when I met the Milltown boys, they all had earrings. And one day, one of the Milltown boys had an Aston Villa badge, football badge, and they decided that ritualistically they would pierce my ear. So they held me down and pushed an Aston Villa badge, heated up with a cigarette lighter, Zippo lighter, to sterilize it, and poked it through my ear. It's a ghastly story, but that's where that particular hole in my ear came from.
Well, let's talk about the Milltown boys then, because as we've already talked about, your career, it's a tapestry. It's made up of so many different things. You know, you're a trustee of the Duke of Edinburgh's Award. You're currently writing a book on post-COVID youth strategies. You're a visiting professor at universities across the world. But the Milltown boys have been in your life for a really long time. In fact, is it 60 years?
50 years? Well, 48.
48 years. Yeah. Let's talk about the Milltown boys. And when did you meet them? Because they were 13 or 14 at the time that you met them. How old were you?
Well, I was 19. So, I mean, this is, you know, you tell the story now and people worry about it, you know, because 19-year-old young men probably shouldn't be knocking around with 13, 14-year-old younger boys. But it didn't seem to matter on that estate at that time. There was all kinds of age overlaps in different ways, you know, sort of tight-knit working-class community. I moved there as a student by accident. You know, I was a second-year student, got offered a flat, went out there. I knew nothing about the reputation of the estate.
And where was the estate, Howard?
Well, I never reveal it, although many people get.
Okay.
But I called it Milltown, and people can even make the connection through the name, because there was a paper mill very close to it, which was probably the best employer of local people. But I moved out there, you know, shortly after moving out there. I went to buy some bread and a newspaper, and I met these three 13, 14-year-old lads outside, and one of them said, lend me a tenner. And £10 was not an insignificant amount of money, but I always say most people, I think, when confronted by three scraggy young men, probably would either hurl a bit of abuse at them and don't be so cheeky, or they'd leg it down the road and get away as quickly as possible. But I think my youth work kind of background, you know, made me curious. You know, why did they want £10? What was that about?
At this point, you were studying social administration, weren't you, at Cardiff University?
Social policy and social administration, yeah, and some criminology. So I asked them, and it was to pay a fine in court. And I couldn't really imagine these. You know, they look very young, and I thought, you know, what have they done to command a fine of £10? And it was burglary. And you know, I thought, well, the next question you have to ask, if I lend you £10, how do I get it back? And they said £1 a week, or no, they said we'll give it you back when we can, or something. So no, we've got to have a better arrangement than that, £1 a week. And they did come, and it's interesting talking to you right now, because tomorrow on BBC Radio 4, there's a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars and the David Bowie album. The first track on the first side is called 5 Years, which was the first book I wrote about these boys, about their lives between the ages of 13 and 18. Bowie has been a thread throughout their lives, and it's the soundtrack of all of our lives, really. And even my latest book from last year, The Milltown Boys at 60, has a David Bowie Aladdin Sane stripe in the sky on the cover picture.
But talking about the because you're seeing them again soon, aren't you, the Milltown Boys?
Tomorrow, yeah.
You're seeing them tomorrow. But you met them at 13, 14. You then, part of your PhD work was talking about the Milltown Boys and this kind of 5-year period. 20 years later, you caught up with them again, and then the Milltown Boys at 60. That's why I got confused. It wasn't 60, over 60, they are 60 years old in the Milltown Boys at 60, aren't they?
Well, they're 62 this year, yeah. Yes, I mean, it wasn't as if I researched them for a bit, then cleared off into the sunset and then reappeared 20 years later. I had, you know, threads of contact with some of them over the years, but not many. I did lose touch with a lot of them during the 1980s into the 90s. But by, you know, 1996, 97, Tony Blair was elected. I was involved in a lot of policy work about young people and exclusion and drugs and school dropout and criminality. And of course, you know, I'm sitting in wearing a suit, you know, not always completely rebellious, and wearing a suit in the, you know, cabinet office structured meeting in London. And I'm thinking, I wonder what happened to the Milltown Boys, because they were the first generation of post-industrial Britain. You know, they'd expected to get jobs in the paper mill, the brewery, you know, the sort of semi-skilled or unskilled manual occupations. And those had all closed down or stopped recruiting. So these were young men with no qualifications, with criminal records. What had happened to them? And I thought, well, you know, it'd be interesting to try to find out. So I spent a year in the year 2000 interviewing them. It produced nearly 500,000 words of transcript, interviewing 30 of them. All my colleagues at the university said, you'll never find them again. They won't want to talk to you. Life's moved on. And of course, they were 40 years old, but not one said no at that time. They all talked to me. One was reluctant at first, but then changed his mind. I interviewed all 5 of the boys I'd profiled in 1978, 79, two of whom are dead now. And then I thought, I've got to do justice to these individuals. You know, they've given me a lot of their time. I've got this vast swathe of knowledge about them. So I went to Denmark as a visiting professor to Copenhagen, and I sort of holed up in a very nice apartment in Copenhagen for a year to write the book, which was then published in 2004. And of course, one of those individuals in the book had been a heroin addict for many years, and he became, when I interviewed him when he was 40, he was just completing a fine art degree. So I asked him to paint the cover of my middle book, and he's still alive, and he's painted the cover of my most recent book as well.
What was the original focus of the work then, back in the 70s when you first met the Milltown Boys?
Well, the first thing, like most things in my life, it wasn't a plan. You know, I didn't meet them and then think I'll do research on them. I met them, and after I'd lent the tenor to this one particular individual and he'd started paying me back, I'd had conversations with them about what they did in their leisure time. And they hung around a particular sort of place they called the club. It was a very tatty and modest sort of youth club. So I used to go up and help, you know, and as a youth worker, you know, and that's how they remember me, in their early impressions of me. You know, who is this posh speaking, you know, long haired? The only saving grace I had was that I did not wear flared jeans, that all students in their view did. But I didn't, because I rode a motorbike, and you can't wear flared jeans on a motorbike. So they quite liked me, because although they were all skinheads and they had straight jeans, I had straight jeans too. These are the sort of silly things that build connections. So for a couple of years, you know, I just got to know them. I lived on the same estate. I saw them in the pub sometimes, and some of the older ones, older brothers. And then I had the opportunity to do my PhD, which was their relationship to the criminal justice system. So I ended up going to court with them, visiting them in young offender institutions, in prisons, talking to their probation officers and their social workers, police officers, and so forth. So that was the focus. That was the first piece of research I did. And then I left. I came back to Birmingham to run a youth centre, and I didn't think I would see them again. And I thought, you know, when you move to a new place, you don't know anybody. So I sat down with a typewriter and I thought, I'll write a memoir of my life with the boys. You know, when I'm middle-aged, I'll be looking back and think, did I really meet people who behaved in this way, who spoke in this way, who had views of the world of their kind? So I wrote this quite long manuscript, which was a purely private exercise. And then a colleague of mine said, have you ever written about the boys? And I said, yeah, but it's a private memoir. And I sent it to her. And she said, you've got to get this published.
Once you knew, though, it started off as a private memoir, but once you knew that it was going to be published, what was your ambition for it? Was it just to be read as a memoir? Was it to make comment on things that need to change for people who find themselves in this particular situation, where they're born and raised in a town where opportunities are not growing but shrinking for different reasons? What did you want the book 5 years to achieve?
I don't think I really wanted it to achieve anything. I think I was rather flattered that somebody thought it merited publication. And there's very little analysis in it. There's very little references to wider academic thinking about youth and delinquency and crime. With hindsight, I would say what I realized I was becoming quite good at was getting into corners of society that most people don't get into, and picking up how those people live their lives and how they see the world, which is a very different way of seeing the world from the way we see the world, or I see the world, and bringing those perspectives into public gaze, I suppose. I certainly say that now about the Milltown Boys study as a whole, and the conclusion of the latest book is very much, unless we understand those private drivers in people's lives, we'll never understand their public behaviour. You know, their drug taking or their employment trajectories, or you know, unless we understand their relationships with partners, with children. And the other thing is that public policy is so much preoccupied with looking back deeply into the roots of your life to find out what made you the person you have become, and planning into the distance, you know, have a kind of 5-year plan and then work towards it. Well, the Motown boys have never operated like that. They don't look back very far and they don't look forward very far. So they have a very different way of living their lives from the way we do. You know, they don't plan holidays because they might be in prison. There's no point. You know, you accumulate some money and then you book a package holiday and you clear off to Benidorm for 2 weeks and you come home again. But don't book a holiday in August, because tomorrow, if you're a shoplifter, you may get arrested and then you're going to be in prison in August. So, and don't look back too far, because it's not a very pleasant set of things to be thinking about if you're looking back, both your own behavior to others and other people's behavior towards you. So it was, you know, your question was about that first book. What did I want from it? I didn't want anything from it. I was just very proud that somebody thought it was worth being a book.
What happened to the Milltown boys then? In terms of, you met them at 13, your first interaction with them was them asking you for a tenner so they could pay for a court fine. Was this kind of early criminality? Did that continue through their lives when you look at the Milltown boys at 60?
The assumption would be that most of them started life in a pretty bad place and that would continue. I mean, the 1970s and 80s were not a time of prospective social mobility. It's quite interesting that, you know, yesterday the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom talked about the right to buy, about people in housing associations, because one of the great things that happened to the Milltown boys was the right to buy under Margaret Thatcher, something that politically I completely opposed and could remain deeply concerned about in terms of how it's had a knock-on effect around who owns properties. And but, you know, some of the Milltown boys actually own the houses they grew up in. They don't live in them, they rent them out, or their children live in them, but their parents exercised the right to buy, or they did in the late 80s, and now they're, you know, about a third of them are homeowners, which would have been inconceivable when they were children if you'd said you will own your own house at some point in your life. They would never have believed that. So there is a good story. You know, some of their children have gone to Russell Group universities. You know, some have done very well indeed. You know, one in particular, you know, has a company with a £6 million turnover. But of course, I could also point to the other end of the spectrum, where there's probably about a third who have followed the predicted routes in and out of prison, too many drugs, too much alcohol, broken relationships. If they're not dead already, you know, they're in a bad way. Jason Mohammed, who you probably do know who he is because he presents Final Score on the BBC, but Jace did he comes from that area, and he did a programme last August, and he and I went to one of the few remaining pubs on the estate, and Jason was amazed that they all remembered me. All these people knew who I was. They remembered me being a good footballer, and he went out. We were eating sandwiches and he went out and said, "Who knows Howard?" And a lot of these people said, "Yeah, we know him. Yeah. And they started talking to him about me. And then I remained hanging around the pub. It was a sunny day till 5 o'clock in the evening, talking to a lot of them. But, you know, they are 6-7 years younger than me, but they look 20 years older than me. You know, a lot of them have disabilities, a lot, you know, they've suffered from the ravages of time. That's the tough side of the story. And then, of course, there's another third in the middle somewhere who have not been active criminals as adults, but that doesn't mean they don't take stolen goods. They've generally worked reasonably continuously throughout their adult lives, but in and out of different kinds of manual employment, but they've usually worked. You know, they've tended to remain with the same partners throughout their lives, but it's what I call parallel but separate relationships. So they both go up to the working men's club, but she plays bingo and he watches the football. And then they walk home at 11 o'clock at night or whatever it is. So it's a very, very mixed and diverse story. And it makes one extremely cautious about some of the research studies that seem to say, you know, we've done a longitudinal study and here's a cohort of people at age 25 and they're on set paths for the rest of their lives, because they haven't always been upward trajectories or downward trajectories. Sometimes circumstances have conspired to shift success into failure or failure into success. And the classic sort of exception to all of those stories in some ways is the artist, who has probably become the closest to me over our lives. He's a very intellectually brilliant man. He became an alcoholic. He left school at 16, became a heroin addict, in and out of prison, did his fine art degree, does some wonderful paintings. I've got some of them. You know, he's done some for me. He's never worked since he got his degree in 2002, I think. But as he says in the book, he said, unlike Van Gogh, at least he sold some of his paintings in his lifetime. You know, and he's an existential, fascinating man. You know, he's got a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And he would probably say his life has been a success. But from people looking in from the outside, you'd probably say his life looks like it's been a failure. So don't rush to judgment on these things.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Bedu, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
I'd like to pick up on you said the circumstance, and I think we're seeing it at the moment too, in terms of the cost of living crisis, the impact that the war in Ukraine is having across the world. Obviously, we've just come out the back of a pandemic. Circumstance feels like it's working against a lot of us at the moment. And that can, of course, you know, as you say, you can have good times and bad times, and that will affect what you're doing and where you end up. But do you think that from a kind of social mobility perspective, from your work with the Milltown Boys, and of course, you know, your youth work in all sorts of different areas across the world, does someone start have it? Of course, it doesn't determine their future, but how much of an impact does somebody start in life have on the rest of their life?
Well, I think there's a, and this probably takes us back a little bit to King Edwards. I think there is something about confidence and competence. Now, somebody like me, you know, I mean, my biggest regret about going to King Edwards is probably that all I ever made in woodwork was a teapot stand. And one of the Milltown Boys once said, let's face it, boys, the only thing that's handy about Howard is he lives around here. Because they're incredibly, and I use that as a tribute in a different sort of book I wrote some years ago. They were incredibly talented in lots of ways, but in ways that were part of their comfort zone. So, you know, they turned their hand from an early age to many things. They could fix motorbikes, and they could make things out of wood, and they could paint and decorate and so on. And I couldn't do any of those things. So that was quite a leveler, really, because I could help them fill in forms for the Social Security and stuff, because I could write. You know, they couldn't write and they were not literate. But I think there's an issue about confidence and competence. In Wales, if I can just digress slightly, in Wales we have a youth policy philosophy called extending entitlement, which I contributed significantly to 22 years ago. We wrote it in the year 2000. And it was basically that I used to ask people in lecture theatres all around the world, why were they sitting in a lecture theatre listening to me and not serving a 14-year prison sentence? And they kind of looked askance and perplexed at the question. But I said, just write down the things that have brought you to this seat in this lecture theatre today, you know, family, school, encouragement, you know, membership of the scouts, the guides, the boys brigade, the cadets, the young farmers, you know, youth organisations, learning musical instruments, travelling to other places, you know, this wide diversity of opportunities and experiences that more privileged young people in our societies usually get because their parents help them to get it. Or their schools have lots of extracurricular activities, as we did in Edgbaston, you know, which, you know, broaden the mind. You know, we weren't allowed to do a general studies A-level as an A-level, but we did general studies. And my word, we had Chris Bonington come to see us and we learned about the polis and Babylonian art and, you know, who knows what, Marxism. Just a real diversity of things. We were exposed to these things. We were encouraged to be curious. We were encouraged to challenge. And I said, you know, when we wrote Extending Entitlement, I said, if we don't offer this package of opportunities and experience to our more disadvantaged young people in our society, let's not be surprised that they remain xenophobic, homophobic, localized. You know, that they, you know, they hate difference. They're comfortable on their own patch, but they've never been stretched to appreciate wider horizons. And so we need to stretch them, this push them into their stretch zone. I mean, I remember saying to some of the Milltown boys, why don't you come to Birmingham with me? Come and meet my parents. Come to a big Victorian house in West Hagley. Oh, and they'd start shaking. These were confident. They looked real confident, hard street kids. But they were terrified of difference. They were terrified of anything that was new. Whereas King Edward's, you know, it sort of inculcates a sense of, yeah, I mean, I don't really want to use the word. It's a kind of sense of superiority. I mean, remember Canon Luntz, every lecture in big school was about you, the future leaders of the nation, you know. And when you look at it, we have been in our different ways, whether it's Lee Child's or, you know, Lord Willetts, you know, Director General of the BBC, you name them. We can find old.
They've been on this podcast, High Court judges and dames of the realm.
You've got them all. And what is inside us is a real deep-rooted confidence that if we want to turn our hand to something, apart from making teapot stands, we can do it. Whereas most of the young people that I've spent time with have any sense of confidence knocked out of them. You know, you're not good enough. You're not going to make it. You're not, you can't get there. You know, it's the wrong, you know, you're the wrong type of person to do that. And part of my mission has been to say, no, you're not. You could do these things. One of the reasons I came to the University of South Wales is that most of our students are first generation learners. You know, without being sounding too disparaging, you know, if we'd had still got coal mines and we'd still got textile and clothing industry as used to be the case in the South Wales valleys, probably a lot of the male students would be down the pit, and probably a lot of the female students would be sewing machinists, industrial sewing machinists, to, you know, genderize it dramatically. But that's how it was. But without those employment pathways and with the expansion of higher education, these people have come to university. Well, some of those young people are as talented as any young people I meet anywhere else in the world, but they don't have the confidence. They don't believe that they are. And I said to the previous vice chancellor, you know, I like being at this university because it's like doing youth work in higher education. It's about giving people belief in themselves. Having said that, you know, there are students who I don't think should be at university at all. They're really not literate and numerate enough. And I think, you know, apprenticeships have been given short shrift in terms of the way we think about transitions to the labour market. But that's a different story.
So what is it then, Howard, that knocks the confidence of young people? Is it society? Is it on a kind of, is it a family level? Is it community? Is it, like you said, localised communities? The Milltown boys, lots of them are still there in the town that they were born and raised in?
Well, again, you talk about the individual, the family, the school and the community, you know, the four kind of major socializing influences. And I used to do a slide in presentations where I just had those four headings, and then I had four pluses or four minuses or pluses and minuses working in different ways, because we know that there are young people who don't get family support, but they have brilliant support from a teacher at school who may instill a great deal of confidence. You have young people who have everything conspiring against them, but somehow they have a gritty determination to make it through and make a difference for some reason. Who knows what it is, but it's sort of individually derived. You have communities that drag people back. That, you know, as one of the Milltown boys said when he tried to do a computer studies course and he dropped out after a few weeks, I said, you know, why did you drop out? He said, I was stifled by my own past, which is an interesting expression. That was actually the same individual who's dead now who asked to borrow the tenor. So I've used him quite a few times. You know, he once said to me, when we were standing at the bus stop after a court appearance, he said, would I lend him the bus fare home? And I said, I'm skint. I've only got enough for myself. And he went into quite a rage at me about, you don't know what it's like to be skint, because you'll never be skint, because you always know somebody who'll lend you something. He said, when I'm skint, I'm skint. I've got nothing. you know, the only way I'll get anything is if I rob it. And we ended up actually walking back to Milltown 3.5 miles because my bus fare bought 2 cups of tea halfway along the journey. But we, you know, we had another good conversation. So these are not clear cut things. It's not as if family, school, individuals and communities all have to pull in the same direction. But too many times people are either not given the grounds for feeling confident to take risks, to have a go, or alternatively, they're told when they do have a go that they shouldn't be having a go because, you know, the world they're trying to reach is not the world for them. And I think this is I once gave a lecture to the local government association about the future of education. And again, it's always interesting reading the Gazette about the International Baccalaureate, because, of course, Kurt Hahn was behind the United World Colleges, as well as the Duke of Edinburgh's Award and Outward Bound. And Kurt Hahn had a particular view of the world and the kind of diversity of learning that people needed to engage in. But Margaret Thatcher wanted to develop enterprise education. And youth work is often about telling young people to be whoever they want to be. And I think what King Edwards did, which is probably a seed planted deep in my soul somewhere, was that what King Edwards helped me to do was to understand when I needed to show initiative and show courage and perhaps cheek and perhaps rebellion in a positive, constructive kind of way, and when to toe the line, when to behave myself and when to be compliant. And what I say is that if we don't help young people to understand that, they get too enterprising in the wrong place and they get kicked out, or they are too passive and compliant and too obedient and then they get left behind. So young people need to be able to read situations, make a judgment about situations to know when it's sensible to keep your mouth shut, when it's important to keep your mouth open.
Howard, I hope you don't mind me saying, you were a scholarship student at King Edward's School, obviously.
I was, yeah. I'd never heard of the place, yeah.
Yeah, so you were fully funded to go through King Edward's School.
Well, I mean, I went to Hagley County Primary School, and, you know, the options were King Edward's Stourbridge, if you passed the 11 plus, or the Grange, if you didn't, went to the Secondary Modern School. And one or two went to the local technical school, which was Old Swinford Hospital School. And then one day the head teacher said to my dad, you know, we think Howard's quite a bright lad. You know, he should put in for King Edwards Birmingham. And my dad told me, and, you know, well, where's that? What is that? It's a good school, Howard, you know. So I had to do the entrance exams. And I did the first one, maths, English, general knowledge, no problem, you know, quite straightforward. And then, you know, I got through that. And then the second one, maths, English, aptitude test, you know, cat, mat, dog, which is the odd one out. I'd never done an aptitude test in my life. I was a bag of nerves. I came out in tears. I thought that I could not possibly have passed this. I didn't even understand the questions most of the time. And all these other kids came out grinning and saying, oh, that was easy. We've done those before. They're all from the local prep schools. They've done French and Latin, and I hated it, and I hated them, and I hated everything. And I remember my dad picking me up and saying, how did it go? And I said, oh, it's terrible. I've messed it up. And he gave me 50p, saying, well, at least you gave it your best shot. Well done. And I remember years later meeting a guy from the CBI who'd grown up in Hagley. He said, oh, you were the kid who your dad gave you 50p before you that he found out whether you'd passed or failed. Everyone else got it only if they passed. I was about the only kid in the village who got recognised for effort rather than for success. I did get it, you know, to my surprise, I did get a place, and it was a scholarship, so it was fully funded. I went there. We were always a group of kids who were clearly not the private school kids. You know, I still hate skiing because all the posh kids went off skiing at Easter, and what was skiing? My wife took my children to skiing this Easter. I refused to go. It's like golf clubs. I'm like Groucho Marx. You know, I don't want to be a member of any club that would accept me. And So I really had a lot of hostility to King Edward's because of some of these divisions. I was the only kid in my class, in Shell B, who had a woolen blazer, because we went to Rackham's and a Barathea blazer was £20 or something. And my mum said, you know, we just can't afford that. I'll buy you a blue blazer and I'll sew a school badge on the pocket. And I turned up. And all these other kids had leather briefcases and they had Barathea blazers. And I had a woolen blazer with a badge sewn on it and a satchel or something, a hand-me-down satchel. I mean, and then I was on free school meals as well. You know, there were all these things that pushed me to the margins. And maybe that's why I started, you know, that's why I could feel a lot of affinity with the Milltown boys, although I'm well-educated and so on and so forth. I could feel that sense of exclusion. And I still don't, you know, when I'm at posh black tie dinners at Buckingham Palace or St James's Palace or Windsor Castle, I still don't feel comfortable in those environments. But I'm capable of functioning brilliantly well in those environments because I went to King Edward's Birmingham.
I think that's what I wanted to get to, really. Do you think that going to King Edward's, because what you're talking about in terms of your life following, you know, you're very privileged, we all were, to go to King Edward School. Yes, we had to work hard to pass the exam and everything else. We had to have the kind of ability to do it. We had to work incredibly hard while we were there. But it was a privilege to be there. And you don't necessarily know it at the time because you're 11, 12 and, you know, you're looking around and this is just what you do. You don't necessarily realise that you're in such a lucky position to go to a school like that. Do you think that going there, did it give you that sense that that's kind of social responsibility that you then carried with you through all of your youth work? Is it that desire to share the experience that you had coming from the background that you did, going to the school that you went to from 11? Did that really drive you, do you think?
I think you've captured me very well, Ben, given the fact that we've only just met. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, what I haven't talked about is that, you know, when I said that as a 10-year-old, you know, the one of the options was the Grange school, the secondary modern school in Stourbridge, you know, I was a good footballer and I went down the park every night and I went down and I probably didn't get beaten up and disliked by the secondary modern school kids because they didn't know what kind of special school I went to. My brothers did. They both went to King Edward School, Stourbridge. And they had a bad time on the bus coming home most afternoons from the secondary modern school boys. But down the park, I was just the clever kid, you know. Howard, I was the more articulate one. I was the smart guy. But I do remember vividly at age 15, some of these kids saying, I've only got 6 months to go at school, because they were leaving at Easter. And I was just thinking, what? Because, you know, school leaving was not even debated in my school circles because we still had 2.5 years minimum, 3.5 years to go. A-level certainly, possibly Oxbridge, and university after that. You know, that was the way we looked at our lives. Whereas these kids, my mates in the park, were talking about, you know, hoping to get a job in the supermarket, hoping to get a job on the building site. And I think that a lot of what I've done in my life has been almost thinking about my mates in the park. And if they had had different kinds of opportunities, different kinds of encouragement, harnessed more of their motivation to do something different, broader horizons, all of those things I've already talked about a bit today, I don't think they saw any other pathway into their future than the one that somebody else told them was going to happen to them. Whereas I was, you know, and I thank King Edward's enormously for just opening the world up to me in terms of ideas and visions and contacts. I mean, I had a lot of criticism of King Edward's. I remember one of the things I've been involved in a lot of my life has been voluntary service stuff, you know, volunteering. And I always remember the school proudly naming a couple of sixth formers who were going off to do voluntary service overseas, you know, in Fiji and Kenya. And then you never heard of them again. So they were named, they were in, you know, they often stood at the front and they talked about what they were going to do, but they never came back to the school to say what they had done and what it had been like. And when I talked to Alec Dixon of Community Service Volunteers, when I talked to Edith Cresson, the European Commissioner, and we developed the European Voluntary Service Programme, all the time I kept saying, we've got to get the loop much stronger. We've got to get people going, and then we've got to tell about what they've done coming back. But unlike some of my scholarship pals, who I'm still in touch with, a couple of them my year, still good friends of mine, one of whom has a fairly neutral attitude towards KES, and the other who's quite damning about it for being a bastion of privilege and elitism and, you know, all the kind of easy criticisms that can be levelled at King Edward School, I remain deeply appreciative of the chances it gave to me.
Howard, it's been absolutely fascinating to speak to you. I said before we started that I love to follow the tangents and I never quite know where these conversations are going to go. I've really enjoyed speaking to you. I have got to end, though, on the question that I ask every single guest that comes on this podcast. And you've spoken about a lot of this, the confidence that King Edward School gave you, the competence, the idea that it broadened your horizons. Is there one characteristic that you can reflect on about yourself that it could either have been developed at King Edward School? It doesn't have to be. It could be something that came in your career later. But one thing that you really think has helped you in your career?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a kind of don't give a damn attitude. In other words, if, you know, it's not the old cliche about when one door closes, another one slams in your face, which is the, you know, classic for disadvantaged people. It's that, you know, if that door closes, another one will open. If, you know, if you don't want me to do that, I'll find something else to do. I've got plenty of hobbies. I've got plenty of wider occupational interests. And, you know, I've got plenty of things that I can do in my life without having to fight hard to do something that somebody might not want me to do. You know, if you don't want me to do it, I don't give a damn. I'll move on and do something else.
So would you say that's an optimism then, Howard? That everything will be all right?
I think it's an arrogance that comes from a King Edward's upbringing. I think it's, is it an optimism? It certainly gives me a lot of power and gives me a lot of strength. I don't feel I have to fight for anything. I've hardly ever applied for anything in my life. People come to me and ask me to do things, and I do them to the best of my ability, which is also a value or a quality that is instilled in me in King Edward's. A quality of education, a quality of, I don't want to call it education, it's a quality of learning experience that the school built in all but a handful of pupils who were either too damn smug or too damn disinterested to benefit from it.
Howard Williamson, 1972. It's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you ever so much for your time today on Ed Talks.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk.